It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. Happy 2018, everybody. Many of you, I suspect, are officially now starting to count forward to next season rather than looking back at last season. And that's what we're here for, is to talk fantasy and to start looking ahead. It's going to be here before you know it. Spring training is coming about 6 weeks. Goodness gracious. So it's still been relatively quiet on the hot stove. There's still a lot of guys out there, but we've had some movement, so we're going to start by talking about some of that movement. And we'll start with Wade Davis. And I want to be kind here. I want to be I want to acknowledge that the people who run the Rockies know more about baseball than I do. With that said, this was easily the most baffling move of this offseason and one of the most baffling moves I've seen in a long time. Wade Davis's numbers have been trending in the wrong direction. His walk rate is up. He's good, but he wasn't really special. 6 home runs in 58 innings last year, and now he's going to Denver. I'm not real excited about Wade Davis in Colorado. Am I overly? And that's even putting aside the contract. That's even putting aside the contract, which just floored me. Just the pitcher in 2018 from a fantasy perspective, he'll be safe because when you shell out that kind of money for a reliever, you're not going to get bumped for the closer's job with 2 bad weeks. But I don't see him as an elite closer. I see him as middle of the pack-ish. Where are you on Davis in Denver?
I'll say I'm a little more positive than you are, but I kind of agree with your middle of the pack-ish, or maybe, okay, so if I'm going to look maybe at fantasy closers right now, I'm going to say maybe around 10th or something like that. So clearly outside the top tier, but solidly in the second tier, and maybe if not 10th, maybe like 12th or something like that, just because there's a lot of closer flux with teams right now. And as you said, he's safe in the sense of he's got as long of a leash as any closer. You and I were really, if I was going to give a positive vote for Wade Davis, I would say you and I were both really down on Greg Holland. He did fine with the Rockies last season. The Rockies look like they're going to have a good bullpen overall, pretty productive lineup. So there should be save chances there for him. I'd say as long as you set your sights on a low 3s ERA, maybe a whip around 1.2. What keeps him also out of the top tier for me is workload. He threw 58 innings last year, 58 2/3. The year before he spent time on the disabled list. I'm not totally sure that he throws 65 or 70 innings this year, which you need to do really to be in the top tier of closers.
Yeah, I mean, that to me, it's a combination of a couple things. One, yeah, I don't have a lot of confidence that he's going to get way up there in the innings, which means that the strikeouts aren't going to be that high. Implosion may be too strong, but I think the risk factor with Davis is extremely high because I don't think, look, he could be a little worse and he could just fall to 3 and 1.2, but I think for a guy who's trending the way he is, guy whose fastball velocity is trending the way it is, whose walk rate is trending the way it is, it could go really bad. And that's what worries me about Davis, is that you're drafting a guy pretty high in most cases. This is not a guy who's going to be a bargain late round, bargain in your auction. This guy's going to get drafted pretty high based on name value, based on secure role. And, boy, that blow-up risk for me with him is really high. And that's what worries me as much as anything. The ceiling is limited and the floor is low. And that's a scary combination as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, so since we're starting to really get deep into our 2018 fantasy preview, and since we don't have a ton of transactions to talk about today, I'll take a minute on Davis. I'll give you a few names, and you can maybe just give me knee-jerk reaction on, you know, if you were drafting right now, you had 10 seconds left on the clock, which closer you'd rather. So, for example, would you rather have Davis or Ken Giles?
I think I'd rather have Giles, but I'd rather have a third option.
Yeah. So how about Hector Neris?
So you're making a point here, and it's a good one. it's a fair point because, you know, the one thing on Davis is he's safe, and I'd probably take Davis just because we don't really know we don't really know what the Phillies are going to do at this point, and I'm not sure that Neris is the guy. So, you know, if it's March 1st, March 15th, the Phillies have made it clear that Neris is their closer, I'm taking him. If we're talking today on January 4th, and I don't know for sure what that situation is going to look like, I probably take Davis.
Yeah, I mean, once we get outside of, you know, Jansen, Kimbrell, Corey Knebel, Aroldis Chapman has his concerns for the season, but I'm sure he's squarely ahead of Davis. But then we get in, you get into, as I start looking down the list, you know, like I said, my next name was probably going to be Sean Doolittle. Really good pitcher on a really good team, but a lot of injury history there. Mark Melancon coming off really a lost year. Aroldis Vizcaino, you know, Shane Green. So there's just, it seems like even in that, and I'm not even down to like, those are maybe around 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th in the closer ranking. So I'm not even down in the 20s where Fernando Rodney and Brandon Morrow and Alex Claudio and some of those pitchers are. So you can start to see where even in the middle rounds of your draft, like it's going to be a bit of a landmine with the reliever position. And Davis has his warts, but the odds of him, I guess, getting 35 saves are reasonably high. So he's probably going to be taken in the, like you said, he'll be taken pretty high, but I think maybe the closing thought for fantasy owners here is, you know, don't put him near that top tier. Don't put him up with Corey Knebel and Chapman and Jansen and Kimbrell and those pitchers.
For what it's worth, I like Doolittle the most out of that whole bunch. I'm kind of willing to take the injury risk because I like the pitcher a lot. I like the situation a lot. I don't think they want to sort of mess around with who their guy is. That certainly could change. They do have options, but I don't really see guys who scare me to knock him out of that role if he pitches well. I like him a lot.
I
touched on this a little bit, and I think this kind of raises one of the questions that we're going to have to sort of acknowledge as we talk fantasy baseball in January, which is that things can change before a pitch is thrown. So today on January 3rd, and I probably should have been a little clearer, what I probably should have said is that once we know who the closers are, then I would see Davis ranking as a mid-tier guy. Right now, you know, the point you make is a good one, which is that, you know, because of the risk built into some of these guys and some of these situations where we don't necessarily know, he ranks higher because we're pretty confident he's the guy. So on January 3rd, he is probably a top 10 reliever for me. On March 15th, I expect I will rank him somewhere around 15, if that makes sense.
Yeah, which really means, like you said in the beginning, that you really won't be drafting him because he'll probably go
that is correct.
In the top 10 closers. And I doubt I'll have him on any team. Someone will probably project him for 37 saves. I will be a little more cautious and maybe project him for 32, something like that. Kind of building in, there's the potential for 40, but there's also the potential for 50.
I would need an over-under of about 25 to take the over on saves for him.
Yeah. I think might be closer to 30, but yeah, I know what you mean. Neither one of us are putting him with that contract. That suggests that the over-under should be 37 or something, or 38, and we're not there.
And I think that's something we've touched on occasionally over the time we've been doing this, but I think it's a really important thing to remember. I think it applies, you know, if you're playing cards, I think it applies, you know, even in, well, anyway, it applies in a lot of ways that people look at sports, is that when you play fantasy on draft day, it's as much about sort of the other people playing as it is about the players themselves. And so when we talk about value, so much of it is how much you or I or you, the listener, value a player relative to the other people in your draft. It's less about absolute value and more about relative value. And so, you know, I think that's one of these things, is that it is really important when you look at how you value a guy to sort of try and be aware of how the people in your league value him and value different factors as well, because that really informs a lot of how you should approach it. And then there are guys where you just have very little information, and that is our jumping off point to our next reliever who has joined a team in the National League West, and that is Yoshihisa Hirano. And you know, the track record for relievers coming over from Japan is pretty good. That seems to be, for whatever reason, a position or a skill set that has translated pretty well. You've had quite a few guys come over and be really successful in that role. Going all the way back to Kazusaki, 20 years ago. But I look at Hirano, and look, we're scouting the stats, and that's always dangerous. But I look at a guy whose strikeout rate has come down consistently over the last few years. I look at a guy who was a little homer prone even in Japan. 17 homers in two, well, not extremely homer prone, but a little homer prone even in Japan for a reliever. And I'm intrigued, but I'm certainly not going to jump until I know he's the guy. So that leads to the question of, who is the guy in Phoenix? Who do you like right now? And is there anybody in that mix who, if you were told he's the guy, you'd like a lot?
Sure. Well, starting with Hirano, I'm with you. I don't see him in the ninth inning. I know he has lots of saves, in his career in Japan. But like you said, the strikeout rate has been dropping. It's just not a great sign. That would be a bad sign for a major league pitcher. I think maybe we missed the prime with him. Like, he just wasn't in the majors during his prime. He's going to be 34 by opening day.
Yep.
He can pitch the seventh inning. I just don't see him in the ninth. That means it's Brad Boxberger or Archie Bradley. If Archie Bradley was the guy, I would be really excited. He would probably go into my top 10 relievers, if not 10th, pretty close. But I'm not totally sold yet that they're going to do that with Bradley and that they won't save him to make him more versatile in other situations, which leads me to say right now it could be Boxberger. So if I was dividing up saves right now, just playing the odds, I would probably put Boxberger and Bradley each at about 18 saves, saying that I don't really see a clear favorite right now. Boxberger hasn't done much the last couple of years, but he has that, I think it was 41 save season with the Rays to kind of show that when he's healthy, he can do the job. So I think if Boxberger looks healthy in spring training, they could decide, let's make him a closer like he was at one point, and now we have the freedom to use Bradley in a lot of situations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that seems like the likely way to go for a lot of reasons. They seem to like Bradley in that slightly more flexible role. If you can really limit Boxberger to three outs at a time, presumably you at least think you're going to take better care of his health. I'm sort of with you. It seems like he's more likely to be the guy, but I like the pitcher more, Bradley. So, again, one of those where we can say what we think now, but a lot is going to depend, is going to change between now and when we have a read as to how they're going to set that all up.
Yeah, and the Diamondbacks are also a team that had a lot of success last year, making the postseason without putting their best reliever as their closer. And Fernando Rodney handled the job. They were happy with it and then happy with what they got out of Bradley. So they may just try a similar situation with Boxberger, who could be better than Rodney was.
Yeah. Julius Chacin has never really had anything approaching a neutral home park. Kind of an interesting sequence with Colorado and San Diego. And now he goes to a neutral-ish to hitter-friendly park in Milwaukee. I like Chacin okay. I can see him as a streaming option. I'm not really crazy about him. What do you think taking him out of San Diego, where he pitched really, really well, and after a year in which he really struggled away from San Diego?
Yeah, I decided I don't think I'm going to totally I'm going to try not to overrate that because it was just 1 year. And really, as you said, in his career, he spent most of his career in Colorado, tough place to pitch, came out of that with some seasons with, he had a season with a 3.28 ERA, a season with almost 200 innings and a 3.47 ERA. So, I mean, it's not like he had years of being kind of ballpark dependent with the Padres. So I'm not going to overrate that. I think that I've always liked Chacin a little more maybe than the average guy does. But I know what he is. So I'm hoping for not a 3.89 ERA again this year. I'm hoping maybe something around 4.2 with the Brewers. I like what you said about him as a streaming option. With the way pitching's been going, there is some room for streaming options that have low fours ERAs. With the streaming option, it'll be interesting to see where you want to stream him. Because if you look around the division, maybe you want to stream him against the homes look a little iffy. Starting against the Cubs looks a little iffy. Starting him in Cincinnati might be a little iffy. With that park, maybe start him against the Pirates, maybe the Cardinals, although their offense is starting to look decent. So it's not a division that has some easy options for streaming, but I could see in a 15-team league I'm drafting him. In a 12-team league I'm probably not, but I might be picking him up sometime.
Tyson Ross goes to San Diego. I have never been a big Tyson Ross fan, but the ballpark is at least intriguing. The thing about San Diego right now, though, is they're still not going to score a lot of runs. It's a really tough division, and some of the places you're going to go on the road are very tough. And one of the places that's even pitcher-friendly is a real tough lineup. So, you know, San Diego is not as automatically fantasy-friendly as you might think just based on the ballpark for a pitcher. I've just never been – I've kind of consistently been low man on Tyson Ross. Do you see a value opportunity with him going back to San Diego?
Not a drafting value opportunity. I mean, he was someone – he had those good seasons, two really good seasons with the Padres, where he had ERA basically across 2014 and 15. His ERA those two seasons right around 3. But what he really did, he didn't have good control, but he kept the ball in the park and he struck out a lot of batters. And that overcame the walks. Well, the problem is last year when he came back from injury, he wasn't striking out a lot of batters and he was giving up some home runs. So I think he's not someone you draft. I think he is someone that you do keep an eye on waivers to see. And what I'm looking for is the strikeout rate, because maybe the home park, like we just talked about with Chacin, maybe the home park can help him with the home runs and get that back under control. So if he came out and was striking out roughly a batter per inning in his initial starts, then maybe I'm interested. But I don't think you should draft him. And like you said, I think the fact that the Padres probably are going to be near the bottom of the league again and run scored, I think that's a strike against him, because even if he can produce even a 4 ERA, that might only result in 10 wins with the Padres. And I don't even know if he can do that.
We're going to talk about some sort of philosophical questions in a moment, because we've really basically run out of transactions. Before we do, I want to take a minute to tell you about the MLB Pipeline podcast, which focuses on all things draft and prospect related. MLB Pipeline's draft and prospect gurus, and I do not use that term lightly, Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, join Tim McMaster each week to talk about what's going on in the universe of MLB's future stars. In a recent episode, Jim, Jonathan, and Tim discussed the prospects headed back to Miami in the Giancarlo Stanton trade, shed some light on the MLB Scouts of the Year. To hear that and more, search for MLB Pipeline in Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your podcasts, and click subscribe. I am never hesitant to rave about these guys. One, they're friends of mine. They're good guys. But there is nobody doing what they do better than they do it, whether it's written or podcasting. I'm a shameless company man, but I also don't lie. And there simply is nobody doing better prospect coverage than Jim and Jonathan. Those guys are exceptional. You should check out what they have to say if you have any interest in prospects.
And from a fantasy perspective, I mean, all I have to say is Cody Bellinger, to think about what would be the fantasy impact of being one step ahead of your league mates on one great prospect. I mean, owners who drafted or were quick to pick up Bellinger, like that's an elite fantasy asset last season who went undrafted in most leagues. So getting your head around in the winter, and this is the time to do it. Get your head around all of these really great prospects, and beyond just the couple top ones. I mean, Bellinger's easy to pick off the top of my head, but every year there are a lot of prospects that come up that make a fantasy impact. So listening to these guys gives you that little edge on your competition.
And I think one thing to be aware of when you talk about prospects, when you talk about real prospect experts, is, you know, I think this is a time of year when everybody really thinks they know prospects. You know, going into spring, you learn who the names are. You know, one of the things these guys can do, and the really good prospect analysis can do, is kind of talk you down, because sometimes you need that. Sometimes in fantasy, more, especially on draft day, more than you need to know who's the hot name, you kind of need to know who maybe you should be a little cool on. And I think that's a really important, you know, we sometimes talk about guys' prospects and opportunity, and I think we try not to get too much into hype on prospects. We sort of try to be realistic. But, you know, I think it's an important thing to remember is that just because you've heard a guy's name and just because people are really excited about him in the long run, some of these guys aren't going to produce right away. Some of them are going to need time for whatever reason, be it skill development, be it opportunity. And one of the things that prospect experts, the guys who really do their homework, can do is tell you, yeah, look, this guy's really exciting, but maybe not right now.
No, it's very true. And I will say, like, I think the key, you said, the guys who really do their homework. And yeah, it's really easy for someone nowadays to pull together information from other sites and release a prospects article during the winter or during spring training and encourage everyone to draft, you know, all these exciting prospects and people get excited about them. But the guys who really do their homework, they're the ones who can have a much, much better chance of leading into the right one and not the wrong one.
So now we will move on to some general topics, probably things that we will revisit multiple times over the next couple of months because what we know changes, and they're just good topics. But we're going to start talking about first-round hitters. Mike Trout is a given. Jose Altuve is a given. And then there are a whole bunch of guys that we're not really sure exactly how you rank them. And some of it's going to be your priorities, and some of it's going to be how your league works. But we talk about first-round type hitters. Let's put it this way. Who is one guy out of the following list that you are really going to have your eye on, and who is one guy that you're kind of going to be willing to let somebody else take that leap? The names that we have in front of us are Paul Goldschmidt, Nolan Arenado, Trey Turner, Giancarlo Stanton, Bryce Harper, Mookie Betts, and Charlie Blackmon. Give me a guy that you're really high on and a guy that not down on, because we're talking first rounders, but a guy that maybe you're kind of willing to let somebody else take him.
Yeah, I'm going to actually get away from the actual players and think philosophically. And I want, if I'm going to draft a hitter in round one, I want some steals. Just the way the landscape is right now with so much power and not a lot of steals, I want some steals from my first round pick. So I would be very interested in Turner and have some interest in Goldschmidt and Betts and Blackmon. I've got nothing against, obviously, like, how would you have anything against Nolan Arenado? But I'd like to get some steals from my first round pick if I'm going to go with a hitter, because that means I'm probably going to need a pitcher in the second or third round, which means, and I don't really want to have to take a pure steals guy in one of those next couple of picks. I'd like to come out of the first few rounds with some steals base, just like I said, just the landscape right now. So Harper be my low man on that list, but I'm probably just not going to draft Stanton or Arenado this year because of that steals philosophy. I'd say the ones I'm most likely to draft were probably Turner and Betts. What do you think about that group? Because I've seen them go in basically every order imaginable in some of the early mock drafts.
I kind of feel like it's we're talking philosophy here. I feel like when you're picking in that range, you're not going to win the league with the third, fourth, fifth, sixth pick, but you sure could put yourself in a hole. And so, to me, the guy that really jumps out from that bunch is Goldschmidt, because I feel like his floor is so high. Mm-hmm. You know, his worst season in the last, he was injured in 14 and was on pace for 29 and 103. He has hit at least 297 five straight seasons. He has had 33 or more in three of those seasons and was on pace for about 30 in another. RBI, really consistent runs. He cranks out runs, and he gets you some steals. He's not going to get you 30 steals again, but I'd feel real safe saying 10, 12 steals. And to me, that broad base, that high floor, that's the guy out of that bunch that I really like, because, boy, the odds are really slim that you're going to regret taking him there. You know, another guy, I think if people are down on him, and we get back to that topic of sort of relative value, if people are down on Mookie Betts after a relatively down year, he's a guy I would be absolutely thrilled if he fell a couple of spots and I were picking him, I don't know, somewhere, you know, later in the first round. I'd have a hard time taking him three, but boy, if he fell a little ways to me, I'd be thrilled. I'm a little cool on Blackmon, I'm a little skeptical that he repeats. But, yeah, to me, the guy out of that bunch is Goldschmidt because, as you know, he is going to get you some steals, even if that starts fading. And, you know, in his age 30 season, I wouldn't be shocked if it does start to slip a little bit. You know, Albert Pujols was a guy who'd get you 10, 15 steals at one point, and then that kind of went away quickly. But that's the guy to me. That's to me, he's a pretty easy third hitter, even just because that floor is so high and the ceiling is high. That's a pretty rare combination.
I agree. I the one player who I've seen kind of pushing him a lot is Trey Turner, because of the fact that, like, it's really easy to see a path for him to even be the number one fantasy hitter. Like he's not far off. The power he's shown is not far off a 20 homer pace. And then he basically steals, when you look at it, he basically steals the base about every 10 at-bats, I mean, maybe even a little more than that. So if he's healthy, it's easy to see him stealing 55 to 60 bases next season. So, I mean, assuming they don't have any sort of philosophical change with letting him run. And I don't think they would. I think he's above the class of base stealer where you give him the green light. That would be my little concern with Turner, but I think some owners get enticed by the possibility of maybe 18 home runs and 60 steals or something like that from Turner. But the downside of Turner is obviously he's the one guy on that list who has never had a monster season. He's had two monster partial seasons, but not one great season. And I think everyone else on that list has had one.
At this time of year, we are also, while we talk players, we're also talking about rules. We're talking about structure. So let's have a little philosophical talk about league structure. What do you feel about leagues moving away from batting average and to on-base percentage?
Yeah, so that's a change they made in Tout Wars a couple years ago in the Tout Wars Mixed League, which I participate in. At first, people were resistant to it. I think it's just that, and I honestly think that was just the human nature to be resistant to change. That being said, now that we use it, I quite like it. You see on-base percentage when you watch games on TV a lot more than you used to. You know, it used to be a complaint saying, oh, I want the box score type stats. I want the stats you see when someone comes up to bat. Well, you see on-base percentage pretty readily now. And just from a general baseball fan perspective, when you're watching your own players on your team perform and they draw walks, well, that's a good thing. I think we're way past the point where now we all agree and understand that drawing walks is a really good thing. So, you know, when you see your player draw a walk and you're in a batting average league, you think, well, I hope he scores, but really he's taken away his chance to hit a home run. He's taken away his chance to drive in a run, you know, things like that. I like the on-base percentage. Like, Matthew, would you be comfortable if your league started switching towards on-base percentage?
I would. I mean, look, it's clearly a better measure of value and ability. My resistance is I feel like getting base hits is a diminishing skill, and I kind of like valuing it. I kind of like I'd almost rather, and then we're starting to get into really elaborate stuff, I almost would rather something like have that separate from other ways to get on base. I don't know, and again, we're getting into really complicated stuff. You start adding a whole extra category, and it gets harder to follow. But I think I do like having batting average as something in fantasy because I think it kind of adds to a degree of difficulty. You know, I feel like on base is maybe a little more consistent. You know, you look at a guy like Betts who at 264 last year, he still got on base at a pretty good clip. So I feel like there's that. And I'll tie it into something I was talking about recently. I was talking about fantasy sports in general to actually an old family friend who didn't really understand it at all. I was trying to kind of explain how it all worked. And one thing I said was that I think fantasy basketball is enormously fun and challenging because the categories don't really correspond. And you can't just say this guy is a good scorer and therefore he's also going to be a good rebounder and a good assist guy and a good steals guy. You know, there's a degree of difficulty when the things you count don't really correlate. And I feel like there's a little of that now in baseball as getting hits becomes a harder thing to do, as singles go away. I feel like valuing something in batting average, I like it. I think it makes it a little more difficult. And so while it's not a true measure of player ability, there are leagues that do that kind of thing. There are pure points leagues. There are all kinds of things that really get after total value. In a roto league, I really kind of like batting average for that reason, that it is a little, because it isn't what it was almost.
Yeah, I will also say that now that I'm in a league with on-base percentage, when you're preparing for your draft and you're ranking players and you're trying to predict their on-base percentage, what you start to realize after a while is you are basically predicting their batting average because, like, their walk rates, for a lot of hitters, their walk rate stays pretty stable from year to year. So when you're guessing the fluctuations on their on-base percentage, you're pretty much guessing the fluctuations on their batting average. Were they lucky or unlucky last year? Trying to predict that a hitter is going to walk a lot more or walk a lot less in the coming season, it's pretty much like throwing darts, like unless you've read something or think you really are onto something. But in general, those aren't really predictable. So when you play in an on-base percentage league, you do end up predicting batting average anyway. So from that measure, I could see the reason for staying with it. Like you said, like I said in the beginning, I like it just because it reminds you as to how valuable the, say, Jose Bautista in his prime or Aaron Judge right now with all the walks that he draws, how valuable those players are. But yeah, I can see your point for sure on batting average.
So a couple more of these. do you see a case for moving from wins to quality starts?
Yeah, I can. I mean, wins seem to be something that a lot of people are, you know, kind of pitcher wins are that a lot of people are against right now, you know, overrating that win stat. I don't mind having pitcher wins, just in the sense of when we do get back to I get that they're not a great representation of a pitcher's skills. Jason Vargas, right, was right up in the league leaders in wins last year. Zach Davies, same thing. At the same time, when a pitcher takes the mound to start a game, we know what's in his head, and that's, I want to win this game. And so the fact that as a fantasy community, we're valuing the same thing that the players are valuing when they start the game, right, to get that pitcher wants to, he wants to not give up runs, but really he just wants to give up the fewest runs possible so that he can win the game. That's the whole point. So for that reason, I kind of like win over quality starts. That being said, it comes back to almost the batting average on base percentage debate, where even though the quality start stat isn't perfect, it is probably a better measure of a pitcher's skill set. Well, it is, than just wins, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually almost more open to this one. I think it's kind of I hadn't thought of it before. I think it's kind of an intriguing idea just because, you know, it is a better measure of the pitcher, and sort of you're less picking context and more picking the player, and I kind of like that. I mean, look, a lot of what we do in fantasy is context-dependent, RBI and runs and even saves, really. But I do kind of see that argument to some extent. You know, I also, again, it's January, so we can sort of pie in the sky here. I'd also be open to something where you only counted wins for starters. You know, I think reliever wins are really weird, and maybe something where you know, because I think that's part of what gets into wins, and it's not often going to determine a league. Those margins are not always that fine, but, you know, I do think that if you're talking about stats that are really kind of weird and dumb to count, reliever wins will be way higher than starter wins.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. You're right. The years where a reliever wins 8 or 9 games and then, you know, someone owns him for a lot of the year and he basically gets almost as many wins as some of the starters, that is really hokey. And then another reliever pitches just as well and gets one win all season. You're right. That is really hokey. And that is one thing that a league would have to balance. If you're switching from wins to quality starts, then that takes a category that is now mostly controlled by starters but a little bit impacted by relievers and makes it solely impacted by starters. So that's something you'd have to factor in. So I can see it. Like I said, I think it is similar to the on-base for different reasons, but similar to the on-base percentage versus batting average thing, where are you trying to play a game or are you trying to find a game that represents the actual production of the individual player? But, and the wins, as you said, has the extra context of being a little more team dependent.
And my feeling just sort of philosophically on that, and I touched on this a couple minutes ago, is that there are games you can play that really get into the really elaborate measures of player value, be they sort of simulation type games like Score Sheet, but there are also point value games that are really get into, really sort of try to break down what goes into making a player valuable. And you can play those if you want to. If you want to really just have your league be who's putting together the best assemblage of baseball players, there are ways you can play. I feel like part of what makes fantasy fun, and this gets back to what I was talking about basketball, part of what makes it fun is it's not that black and white. It's not just about who is the best player right now, because that's kind of a boring draft. It's how do I win this game? And that's, again, to me, that's part of what makes fantasy fun and interesting. So I'm not really in favor of worrying too much about making fantasy scoring a direct representation of what makes good baseball players.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think there's a wide spectrum there among fantasy owners who see it. Some people see it as really heavily as a game, and then some people want it to really try to accurately reflect the impact, like the value and impact of actual baseball players on their actual teams. And the truth is, you're never going to get 100% of the way there, right, to mirroring the impact they have on the baseball team. So you should just view it as a game, and it's its own separate entity. Where the one thing I do like about fantasy baseball in comparison to other fantasy sports, I agree with all your sentiments on fantasy basketball. I think it's a lot like fantasy baseball in a lot of ways. The one of the things I never really enjoyed that much about fantasy football is that I found it didn't really accurately measure the impact that a lot of players have on the game as well as fantasy baseball does, where at least when we're looking at fantasy rankings, the top players in baseball are the top players largely on our list.
And then one more in this whole discussion is looking at relievers. Do you see a compelling case? Some leagues just count holds. Do you see a compelling case maybe to do something like saves plus holds instead of saves, or instead of saves and holds as separate categories?
Yeah, I can see saves and holds together as a category if you want to move your league towards valuing relievers on their skill set, right? Like we'll talk a lot about Fernando Rodney and not much about Tommy Kahnle or David Robertson, say, coming into this season, because Kahnle and Robertson are going to pitch in a really deep Yankees bullpen, get a bunch of holds, pitch really, really well, but probably not get more than one or two saves. Rodney's going to get a bunch of saves, so fantasy owners are interested in him. If you want to move your league more towards drafting skills with relievers, drafting the really, like, really valuing relievers based on how good they are, then make it saves plus holds. Basically, if a reliever is really good, he's going to be used in high leverage situations. He's going to get you either saves or holds. It makes it a little less game-like, because now, you know, a closer loses his job and you don't panic and drop him because you think he's still going to be used in high leverage situations if you still believe in the pitcher. So I could see moving there, just in the sense of maybe of all the fantasy stats, the saves one is maybe the hokiest, in the sense of you're really heavily playing just manager decision-making as much as you are the actual player. That all goes into playing time for hitters and therefore how many stats they can compile, but not near as much as it does for the relievers with saves.
And if we're adjusting sort of for reliever value, I'd almost like to find some kind of way that you get punished for having a pitcher who pitches poorly and gets saves, as I am for valuing setup guys. And I don't know what that is, but somehow, because look, a reliever who posts a 4.5 ERA and a 1.4 whip and gets you 35 saves, you know what? He's still pretty valuable because he's not pitching enough innings for that ERA and that whip to really hurt you. And so I don't even know what it is. I would like to find some kind of way where that's a harder decision to stick with that guy.
Yeah, well, and to try to at least move a little closer to that, your category could be saves plus holds minus blown saves, minus blown holds also.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, if he can walk the line and get the 4.5 ERA without blowing any saves or many saves, then I guess, like his real team, you're satisfied with him. But if that 4.5 ERA gets you 30 saves but 9 blown saves, then you're not so happy about him anymore.
And this kind of leads into our next category, and also this sort of reflects something we talked about a little earlier. There were only 11 guys who got 30 saves last year. Lowest number to reach that since 1994, which was, of course, a strike-shortened season. Lower even than 1995, which was a partly shortened season as a result of coming out of the previous year. Does that affect how you draft? And we, you know, I think this is something we've talked about a lot. Like, not even now, but if you're talking about mid-March, how much does that turnover affect less how you look at a Jansen? Because I think a Jansen kind of guy, those really elite guys, Kimbrel, I think, is back in that class at this point. You know, those guys are going to go where they go. To me, the question is the guys who seem secure. Somebody like, we were talking a little while ago about Doolittle. With the knowledge of how much turnover there is in that spot, how does that affect how you value safe but not truly elite closers?
Yeah, I think I have two takeaways from it. First of all, the 11 pitchers getting 30 saves probably will prove to be a bit of an aberration, and they'll probably be 15 next year or something like that. But I think it is notable in the sense of I'd be shocked if that number goes up to 20. You know, pitchers getting 30 saves next year, and we just have way less volatility at the position. There's going to be volatility. I think for me, there's two takeaways. One, even though it's not that exciting of a pick, I don't mind using a fairly early pick on one of the really reliable ones, picking a Kimbrel in round 5 or something like that, just to get my saves base. And then the other takeaway for me is I wouldn't mind using one or two of my late picks on a skilled setup man who I think could get into that closer's role, either through injury or just taking over the job at some point during the season. Maybe especially if I'm in a league that's deep enough where I could use that skilled setup man, you know, some weeks or some days if it's a daily league, just to get the low ratios. Maybe it isn't Archie Bradley if Boxberger gets the job and you don't really trust him, right? So late, nobody wants Archie Bradley because he's not going to get any saves. You grab him late because when you see 11 closers, like only 11 pitchers getting 30 saves, you know that most teams are dividing them up, which means that skilled setup man probably gets his chance at some point.
One last somewhat similar topic, though also kind of opposite. Nobody threw 215 innings last year. Nobody won 19 games last year. Broadly, we have seen this trend. Look, broadly, we know usage is going more towards relievers and more away from starters. Though, as you said with the saves, I feel like that's probably a little bit of a blip. I don't think those are unattainable numbers, and I think it's not unreasonable to think that some guys will get to that. You know, I expect Max Scherzer to make 30-some starts. I expect Steven Strasburg to make 30-some starts, at least 30 or so. You know, so I don't think those numbers are unattainable. To me, it's kind of a similar thing. What it does is it really makes me value the guys with a realistic shot at getting to those numbers, I think. And we talked about this last year going into the season. Those guys who can not only pitch at an ace level, but can pitch at an ace level for large numbers of innings are just enormously valuable. And I think that the kind of conversation in fantasy around starting pitchers has changed, and rightly so, about how you value those guys who can not only put up great ratios, but can do so over 200, 210, 220 innings. And in the case of somebody like Scherzer, can do so on a good team, and you can be confident that win total is going to be high. So I don't know how you look at that. I'm curious what you think about what those numbers mean. To me, what it means is that the value of guys who can push those numbers is higher than ever.
That's right. And I picked, just for our script, I picked the very high end of the most wins and the most innings. But as we go down the list, you can see so many starters who are making the 30 starts, but because they're throwing 5 and 6 innings per start, you know, they're making the 30 starts and throwing 100, they're only throwing 170 innings or something like that. So you can't even in a good year, unless their management changes, in a good year, they're still not going to get anywhere close to 200 innings. So the value of those pitchers who will throw 215, 220, 225 becomes really valuable. And to take it back a couple of conversations, and we talked about all those first-round hitters, and the truth is, I don't think I'm going to end up taking any of them this year, because I feel like if I don't end up with Trout or Altuve, for example, I'll probably just take a pitcher in the first round, because I think the value of a Corey Kluber or a Max Scherzer, someone who can get you 215 innings, 18, 19, 20 wins, 250 to maybe 260, 65 strikeouts, it's so great. And if the average starter is throwing fewer innings, that means your team is compiling less innings than it did, say, 3, 4, 5 years ago, which means that the guy who throws the 220 innings has more of an impact mathematically on your ERA and WHIP than the same pitcher would have 5 years ago. So basically, you know, and what we're seeing ERA and WHIP rising kind of across baseball, and for those elite pitchers, it's not rising. So the value of someone with an ERA in the twos, with a WHIP around 1.0, 18 wins, 220 innings, 260 strikeouts, it's greater than it was a few years ago. I think that pushes those pitchers into the first round.
That's a really good point that I am not sure I had seen raised. So one last thing before we go to follow on that. How many starters are there that you would be willing to take with a first-round mixed league pick? Is the number 4?
Yeah, Kershaw, Scherzer, Sale, and Kluber. And to be honest, I am having no success in ordering them right now. And it's something I'm putting a lot of thought into as far as Kershaw should be number 1, but the injury concerns, I've looked at, you know, divisional opponent. I think a lot of how I rank them will end up being based on the direction of other teams in their division and which of them look like they might have the easiest divisions to pitch in by opening day when these kind of 100 free agents that are still sitting out there sign, and which divisions look like they're rebuilding a little more than others. I can't really order them right now, but I think they're all first round picks. And I think one of the big reasons to me, beyond the reasons I've already mentioned, the drop off below them is, to me right now, is pretty steep. Like when we start talking about who's next and you look at Madison Bumgarner coming off a really injury-plagued season, Steven Strasburg, who seems to have some injury every year, Carlos Carrasco, who just I don't know if we can count on 200 innings from him yet, even though he got there last year. Jacob DeGrom, to me, there's a big drop to get to that next tier. Justin Verlander, those pitchers. Luis Severino, is he going to follow it up with another great season? To me, those top four are so safe, and then there's questions beyond them, which to me means those four are first-rounders, and I'm not sure if there are many second-rounders.
Yeah, that's what I was about to ask you. I'm not sure there is either. It's a really interesting question as far as, I don't think the tier one is going to be hard to figure out when we get to that coming up in February or March.
No, not at all.
All right. Well, that was fun. We will be back with you again in 2 weeks. Thanks, Fred Zinke, for taking the time to talk. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Happy New Year. This has been the Fantasy 411.